Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories of the past from God's own country, Yorkshire.
Hi, and welcome to No Heathen Land. Happy Yorkshire Day, she says tentatively, hoping this actually does go out on the 1st of August. But happy Yorkshire Day, whatever day you listen to this. I'm just very happy that you're here. So before I get into this episode, I just wanted to make a fun announcement, and that is that I'm going to be hosting a live No Heathen Land. Yes, I'm a real life person, and I want to welcome anyone that would like to come and listen and watch with your eyes live. I'll be recording a live episode from Leeds Central Library in November, as part of a big exhibition coming to libraries at the end of October. I'll be chatting all things spooky and strange, centred around one of, I think, the best books in Central Library Special Collections. I'll leave what that book is as a cliffhanger, but I can tell you I will be joined by three guests, and we'll no doubt have lots to chat about and probably laugh too much about as well. As soon as the date's solidified, I'll be posting about it on social media, talking about it on the podcast, and there will be info coming from Leeds Library's social media too, like a Facebook event page, that kind of thing. So stay tuned. I'm really, really excited to do this, and invite people along if you want to come, so yay! Without too much more chit-chat, this special Yorkshire Day episode is with best friend of the podcast, Dr. Ross Horsley, and I like to use his proper title because I don't think he makes enough of it. If I were a doctor, everyone would know about it. So anyone that knows me in real life, or indeed Ross in real life too, will know that we love vampires, in particular, of course, Dracula. A recent trip to Whitby around summer solstice got me all hyped up for all things Dracula again, and I gave a lot of thought to the significance of Whitby and its landscape specifically in the book and later in films and TV adaptations and in culture and the arts in general. So that is the theme of our chat today, and I would absolutely love to hear anyone else's thoughts on this, and what we might have missed out from the conversation. Just a couple of notes here too. I want to thank my friend Paul, who came on the recent trip to Whitby with me and has been invaluable correspondence about this subject. So thank you, Paul, for your enthusiasm on the topic and for always being willing to chat with me about it. Please go and follow Paul on Instagram, especially if you like moody gothic photography. You won't be disappointed, and you might see some photos of Whitby there too. I will link his Instagram. The handle is October_country_ in the show notes. Finally, just so I've covered everything, towards the end of the episode I mentioned something that I'm talking about being covered in a TV show, but I couldn't remember the name of the TV show, and it is Mystic Britain. All become clear if you listen to the end anyway. So no further chat from me today. At the end of the episode, there's enough here. You'll hear me laugh a lot in this episode, so much so that I might have to ban my own enjoyment from the next episode to make up for it. Anyway, happy Yorkshire Day once again, and I hope you enjoyed this Dracula episode of No Heathen Land. Right, hello and welcome back to Ross Horsley, to No Heathen Land. This is your fourth visit.
Hello, I'm very happy to be back for my fourth visit. I can't believe it.
So the other episodes that we've done with Ross have all been quite special ones. So we've had two spooky specials. And the first episode was with you as well. And then this episode is for Yorkshire Day. So I'm saying this is going out on the 1st of August. Let's see, because it never works out like that for me. But yeah, that's, you know, it's the 27th of July today. So I've got a free weekend.
You can do it. You know you can do it.
Yeah. So I'm really glad that you thought that this was a good subject for us to talk about. So whilst it's August, so it's not quite spooky season, you just said that it's just past 100 days to Halloween.
Yeah, we're on the way to Halloween now.
So, yep, so that's on its way. And much of this subject that we're going to be talking about is actually set in August. So whilst it's not typically a summer being a spooky season, it's kind of like on the way there, getting to the end of summer and sort of like nights drawing in. And
I love that. And I genuinely think there is something a little bit spooky about summer, actually. the way it's light later, but then you're out and suddenly it's starting to go dark, and it's sometimes a bit oppressive, and we get these summer storms.
Yes, exactly. Yes, we have. And we have been having actual storms here recently. So, Today we're going to be talking about Dracula, the one and only. Mr. Dracula?
Dr. Dracula.
Yeah, Count Dracula. So, about the book, Dracula. So, I've recently been on a trip to Whitby at solstice, and it was lovely. It was really nice weather. I got a sunburn. I did all the like spooky Dracula things. So I went to the beach and we went up to the church and we looked over the sea and in the graveyard, and it was great. And since then, so this was about 4 weeks ago, I've been thinking quite a lot about the significance of the landscape, mm-hmm. specifically of Whitby, and how important it is to me, and I think probably, surely to Bram Stoker as well, when he wrote Dracula. And there's some cool facts that we will share, won't we, about why we think that's significant. So I just wanted to talk about the significance of the Yorkshire landscape in this, like, probably, like, the number one iconic Gothic novel of yeah. all time. Is that a bold statement?
No, I think it's absolutely accurate. That's why we both love it.
Yeah.
It does. It sets the template. It does everything you want it to do.
It does.
Reads like it was written recently, mm-hmm. even though it's got all that beautiful kind of Victorian
yes.
style to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I've just thought I'd share like a little introduction of notes that I've made. So the edition that I have is... It's so well used. It's just one that I got, I think maybe when I was at university. It's just a Penguin Classic one, but it's got some really good notes in the front from a couple of editors. So I just thought I'd give like a little bit of context. If you haven't read Dracula, please read it.
Read it. You won't regret it.
We are going to be talking about some of the adaptations for screen as well, so films and TV series. And... how the Yorkshire landscape appears in them or doesn't, because something that I've been thinking about a lot as well is how much it doesn't appear in popular culture for some reason, even though to me like Whitby is synonymous with Dracula.
Yeah, it's kind definitely. Of the forgotten part of the story, and it's really, well, I think we're both going to argue that it is almost the crux of the story and its atmosphere.
Definitely. So just for a tiny bit of context, the book Dracula was first available on the 26th of May, 1897, and it was priced at £6. So apparently the idea came to Bram Stoker in a dream, like a vague dream. But we both had this fact, didn't we, that actually so Bram Stoker was on holiday, on a wet holiday in Whitby in July to August 1890. He found the name Dracula in a dull book about Moldavia, written by a retired diplomat in Whitby's museum and subscription library. So I don't know how where this still exists. I haven't been to the library in Whitby, have you?
I haven't. Well, actually, yes, I have. But it's not in the building that it originally was.
Okay.
The building still exists that Stoker did his research in. But it's been sold, it's been repurposed. The library's now moved somewhere near the train station. I only know that because I once went to Whitby on the National Express and I was so bursting for the loo when I got there that I had to run into the library.
Okay.
It definitely wasn't the place where
as librarians, we know that is probably the most frequent use for libraries is using the toilet. Yeah, so, you know, you're just keeping up with everyone else. Okay, that's good to know. I can sort of imagine him, like, you know, perusing the shelves on this wet afternoon and, like, touching all the books and thinking, oh, do I want to know about Moldova? Maybe. and that's where he found the name Dracula. So it's pretty common knowledge that Bram Stoker was, like, an assistant to Henry Irving, the very famous playwright. And what I did find out was apparently, originally, the book was set like a play in four parts. So part one was Transylvania to Whitby. Part two was Tragedy in Whitby in London. Part three was Discovery. And part four was Punishment.
Wow.
So probably because of him being so engrossed in the theatre life, the style of writing is really fragmented. And I think this is sort of reflects the way that it was written. Apparently he wrote it on loads of different notepads in hotels and on trains and in libraries. Wow. So it's all these little bits. And obviously that's still the case, you know, like we're going to read some bits of the book, and it's made up of diaries and letters and newspaper articles and that kind of thing. So you can see where that came from. And probably my last cool fact was that the book was actually going to be called The Undead, and it was changed at the last minute.
Oh, I'm glad they changed it.
Yeah, me too. Can you imagine? I think that's just, like, Dracula's such a good name.
It's and just
you can iconic. Imagine what the, like, the font of it and everything absolutely. As well. The Undead doesn't quite have the same no. sort of ring to it. So, yeah, I mean, there's quite a good quote as well from this edited version that I've got, which is that the book gestures a feeling that some gigantic evil was gnawing away at Christian self-confidence.
Wow.
So I think even at the time, it was, fairly significant. I don't think it sold too well until after his death.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. I think he never really knew how successful it was going to be.
Yeah.
And it's never been out of print.
Mm-hmm.
Which That's is incredible.
Really impressive. So the reason why I wanted to do this episode, not only because I've just been to Whitby and I've been thinking about this, and the reason also why I wanted to do it with you is that you know that I love anything to do with vampires. And I think we've had lots of conversations about Definitely. Anything to do with vampires, any kind of film that's about vampires, yeah. especially we will talk about. So I just wondered what your feelings on Dracula were, because I think mine are just really clear that I just think it's... So it's genuinely one of my favourite books, and, like, my mum loves it too, so I think she might have bought me this copy as well.
I love the fact that your copy is so obviously loved. It's been shoved in your bag, it's been doodled and written on, it's brilliant.
Yeah, and I have now marked some of it in pen, so, like, no one else has allowed it. I should write some kind of, like, romantic note in the front just in case someone finds it one day, and they think that I did something amazing with my life,
yeah.
instead of, like, sit around, like, talking about things that I don't know enough about. So I just wonder what your feelings on Dracula were and vampires, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a book that I've always loved too. I think I first read it probably when I was about 13, 14. Mm. The style of it really surprised me. I didn't know before I read it that it was going to be, as you say, this mixture of letters and journal entries and news stories. And I think that makes it even better. I wouldn't normally go for something like that. I think I always want my novels to be sort of quite classic in their style. But I think... because it comes from all these different sources, which is obviously a bit of an attempt to make it all seem real, which I think works.
Yeah.
But what I also think it does is it becomes almost like an encyclopedic novel. So that whole idea intrigues me, that you write a novel that that contains all these facts and characters and has a world between the covers. And I think Dracula does that, particularly with kind of folklore, and especially, yeah. obviously, vampire folklore, which I don't know whether this is true, but I imagine it's probably the first kind of fictional story to bring together so many, you know, facts from folklore. I'm saying facts, it's the opposite of
yeah, fact. Yeah.
But to, you know, to collect all these ideas together and just kind of imbue the whole narrative with you know, spooky detail, which I think it does so, so well.
Yeah. And then, like, sort of ever since Bram Stoker's death, say from the 30s onwards, like, there's just a steady stream of Dracula in pop culture
yeah.
everywhere.
Yep, every decade has more than one kind of big yeah. adaptation, and it's always, you know, finding new media, whether it's, you know, games, mm-hmm. toys. It's just been part of everything, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. We'll come on to a little bit of that towards the end, but what I wanted to do was read a couple of passages from the book that I have painstakingly chosen over the course of 2 weeks that represent how significant the landscape is to the book. And then after that boring bit of listening to his talking, which I will love, but I don't know how interesting that is to other people, hopefully you love it. So we will talk about how it pops up in, like, popular culture, films and TV and that kind of thing, and how it portrays the landscape as being significant or not at all. So, let's start. So, I'm going to read from Mina Murray's journal, and then Russell's going to read a little bit of the newspaper article.
Yep. Reading aloud from someone's diary just seems really wrong, doesn't it? when you're reading it yourself, you just feel like you're secretly perusing the pages. When somebody's reading aloud, that's like an ultimate taboo being broken.
So this is chapter 6 from Mina Murray's journal. Right over the town is the ruins of Whitby Abbey, which was sacked by the Danes, and which is the scene of part of the Marmion, where the girl was built up the wall. It is the most notable ruin of immense size and full of beautiful and romantic bits. There is a legend that a white lady is seen in one of the windows. Between it and the town, there is another church, the parish one, which is a big graveyard all full of tombstones. This, to my mind, is the nicest spot in Whitby, for it lies right over the town and has full view of the harbour and all up the bay to where the headland called Kettleness stretches out into the sea. It descends so steeply over the harbour that part of the bank has fallen away and some of the graves have been destroyed. In one place, part of the stonework of the graves stretches out over the sandy pathway far below. There are walks with seats beside them through the churchyard, and people go and sit there all day long looking at the beautiful view and enjoying the breeze. I shall come and sit here often myself and work. Indeed, I'm writing now with my book on my knee and listening to the talk of three old men who are sitting beside me. They seem to do nothing all day but sit up here and talk. The harbour lies below me with, on the far side, one long granite wall stretching out into the sea with a curve outwards at the end of it, in the middle of which is a lighthouse. A heavy sea wall runs alongside it. On the near side, the sea wall makes an elbow crooked inversely, and its end, too, has a lighthouse. Between the two piers there is a narrow opening into the harbour which then suddenly widens. It is nice at high tide, but when the tide is out it shoals away to nothing, and there is merely a stream of the Esk running between the banks of sand with rocks here and there. Outside the harbour on this side there rises, for about half a mile, a great reef, with a sharp edge of which runs out behind the south lighthouse. At the end of it is a buoy with a bell which swings in bad weather and sends in a remorseful sound on the wind. They have a legend here that when the ship is lost, bells are heard out at sea. I must ask the old man about this. He's coming this way. The steps are a great feature of this place. They lead from the town up to the church. There are hundreds of them, I don't know how many, and they wind up in a delicate curve. The slope is so gentle that a horse could easily walk up and down. I think they must have originally been something to do with the abbey. So this next bit is talking about when things start to sort of go a little bit south. So the weather's coming in and everything's getting a little bit spooky and scary. So this is also from Mina Murray's journal, and this is the 6th of August. 6th of August. Last night was very threatening, and the fishermen say that we are in for a storm. I must try and watch it and learn the weather signs. Today is a grey day, and the sun, as I write, is hidden in the thick clouds over Kettleness. Everything is grey, except the green grass, which seems like emerald amongst it. Grey earthy rock, grey clouds, tinged with the sunburst at the far edge, hang out over a grey sea into which the sand points stretch like grey fingers. The sea is tumbling in over the shallows and the sandy flats with a roar, muffled in the sea mist drifting inland. The horizon is lost in a grey mist. All is vastness. The clouds are piled up like giant rocks, and there is a brool over the sea that sounds like some presage of doom. Dark figures are on the beach here and there, sometimes half shrouded in mist, and seem men like trees walking. The fishing boats are racing for home, and rise and dip in the ground, swell as they sweep into the harbour, bending to the scuppers. So then we're going to come to chapter 7, which Ross is going to read.
Chapter 7, cutting from the Daily Graph, 8th of August, pasted in Mina Murray's journal, from a correspondent, Whitby. One of the greatest and suddenest storms on record has just been experienced here, with results both strange and unique. The weather had been somewhat sultry, but not to any degree uncommon in the month of August. Saturday evening was as fine as was ever known, and the great body of holidaymakers laid out yesterday for visits to Mulgrave Woods, Robin Hood's Bay, Rig Mill, Runswick, Staithes, and the various trips in the neighbourhood of Whitby. The approach of sunset was so very beautiful, so grand in its masses of splendidly coloured clouds, that there was quite an assemblage on the walk along the cliff, in the old churchyard, to enjoy the beauty. Before the sun dipped below the black mass of Kettleness, standing boldly athwart the western sky, its downward way was marked by myriad clouds of every sunset colour, flame, purple, pink, green, violet, and all the tints of gold, with here and there masses not large but of seemingly absolute blackness, in all sorts of shapes, as well as outlined in colossal silhouettes. Shortly before 10 o'clock, the stillness of the air grew quite oppressive. The waves rose in growing fury, each overtopping its fellow, till in a very few minutes the lately glassy sea was like a roaring and devouring monster. White-crested waves beat madly on the level sands and rushed up the shelving cliffs. Others broke over the piers and with their spume swept the lanthorns. The wind roared like thunder and blew with such force that it was with difficulty that even strong men kept their feet or clung with grim clasp to the iron stanchions. It was found necessary to clear the entire piers from the mass of onlookers, or else the fatalities of the night would have been increased manifold. To add to the difficulty and dangers of the time, masses of sea fog came drifting inland, white, wet clouds which swept by in ghostly fashion, so dank and cold that it needed but little effort of imagination to think that the spirits of those lost at sea were touching their living brethren with the clammy hands of death, and many one shuddered as the wreaths of sea mist swept by.
Love it.
It's great, isn't it? It's so good.
Yeah, especially the that newspaper article is like, can you imagine someone writing a newspaper article like that now? Like, there's a storm coming and I'm also going to write 3 pages of description about what the weather's looking like.
In every single colour of the sunset.
Yeah, you've got
it. But it's when you read it again, like, I'm struck by that. It's all really Bram Stoker, isn't it? He's using all these different characters, but quite often he's writing from the first person. And it is him. It's his holiday. It's his view of the sunset. It's exactly what he's seen and enjoyed.
Yeah. And like I say, because I've been recently, it was so nice to sort of go right up to the spot where Mina exactly is talking about and look out over the pier in the lighthouse. Because I was speaking with my friend when we were there, and I was like, I don't actually know if like that, it always looks like that where those two piers are. And then when I came back and read the book, I was like, yes, it actually does. It's exactly the same.
It's hardly changed at all, has it?
No, it's not allowed to change it.
It's brilliant. It's so descriptive, but you're right. It's as if he's describing, you know, as we would see it.
Yeah. And so as not to sort of like keep reading from the book, because it's kind of difficult to do, isn't it, out loud? one of the later bits that I really like, and we'll talk about this in relation to a couple of the films, is when Lucy is sleepwalking and she sleepwalks out of the house and up the 101 stairs that Mina can't possibly count, apparently. There's hundreds of them. But now we know there's 101. It's
199.
199?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Every time I count them, I get a different answer. So, but I think they're known as 199.
Where did I get the 101 from?
Dalmatians.
Oh, yeah. That's the next podcast episode. Yeah. So, up the 199 steps to the top, where and as she's walking up there, Mina wakes up and notices that Lucy is gone and chases after her through the little streets of Whitby with her shawl blowing in the darkness and doesn't see a soul. Everything just, you can just imagine it, because everything shuts at 10 o'clock in Whitby as well, so if you go after like any daylight, then you're not going to see anyone because everything's shut. So you can just imagine her walking up these steps and it's been so quiet and eerie, no lights. And then at the top of the steps, Mina sees Lucy being, well, bitten, I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, definitely. By Dracula over one of the tombstones, and then sort of goes to save her, and then everything sort of is terrible from then on.
I'm guessing that's one of the first appearances of Dracula in the kind of British sections of the book.
Yes, I think so. I think that might be... Is that the first appearance? It's quite, like, all the bits that I've chosen to talk about from the book are at the beginning, because it specifically is set in Whitby, and much later in the book, which is why we're not talking about sort of, like, Jonathan Harker and Van Helsing and the other characters that come into it, because it's not set in... It's not set in Whitby. I don't care about it.
But I think it probably is, because... He, as we all know, he arrives by boat, doesn't he, to Whitby? And there's reports of this large dog jumping off the boat.
Yes.
And we obviously, we kind of get the allusion to the fact that that is Dracula in an animal form.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that is the kind of thing. This is why I think Bram Stoker chose this location, because almost anything can happen in this spooky place.
Yeah.
He was very influenced from the conversations he had that he, you know, puts in Mina's voice with the locals who tell him all stories about spectral dogs and all sorts of spooky things. And it just is so fitting that we get to meet Dracula.
It's just popped into my head, and I'm wondering why I didn't check this, but I wonder if Bram Stoker visited Transylvania.
I don't think he did. I think his research, I think he did a lot of research into the area, but I believe he did about 7 or 8 years research whilst writing the novel,
so it was
huge.
Published in 1897.
I think he started
1890.
So I might be wrong, but I don't think he did visit Europe.
It's so interesting, like, that he decided to make that Gothic comparison between the Gothic Transylvania and the Gothic Whitby.
Yeah.
But perhaps Gothic wasn't the word that you would use for Whitby at the time, I'm not sure.
I was thinking about this recently because a friend said to me that he found it amusing that we all think of Whitby as the place to go, so, you know, following the stories of Dracula, was clearly Victorians went to Whitby as well for holidays.
Yes.
Did they go, like you say, because they found it spooky and atmospheric? I'm pretty sure Bram Stoker did.
Yeah.
But it's always been this destination, hasn't it?
Even it has, like, the Mina and Lucy go to Combalets, basically, which is also what I would choose to do, to go to Whitby and just, yeah, I just find it quite a nice, relaxing place, but it does have that, like, air of...
It does. It's clearly not the South Coast, is it? Or it's a bit of a journey from London. It's a bit of commitment.
It would have been a long journey from London. Yeah.
And I think that's, for me, what Whitby is in the book. It's a definite other space to London and its, you know, surrounding counties. It's somewhere that's, for me anyway, sort of a halfway point between this completely unimaginable, you know, Transylvanian setting and then the normality of London and the places a lot of the readers might be familiar with, or that he worked in the theatres there and stuff. But you've got this halfway stage, this spooky mid place that people don't know as much about, and where
that's a good way to put it, like a mid space. So,
history's a bit more alive there.
Yeah, so my lovely friend Paul that I went to Whitby with, who I'm going to credit for quite a lot of stuff in this because we had lots of conversations about it, and I'm very grateful for all his input. I just remember something that he'd said about Whitby as a place and that Dracula coming to Whitby being significant. So originally it's a holiday destination for the girls to go and have, like, a lovely time, and then Dracula comes and, like, literally contaminates it by bringing earth and himself and you know, becoming these, like, spooky animals, and, like, literally contaminating somewhere that's sort of, like, beautiful and like a place to convalesce and rest.
Yep. And I think it also plays on that idea of, you know, Britain being very London-centric and people who live in London not kind of looking beyond the boundaries of London very much, or treating anything with suspicion, particularly that comes from the north.
Mm.
And I mean, the author himself, Bram Stoker, he's Irish and he's moved over from Ireland to London, and although he's obviously been accepted into the heart of London society, he'll also be very aware of this feeling different and this kind of stranger from a strange place that he must have felt like.
So without making myself sound really silly by talking more about the book, I've got, like, a little list of other pop culture things which I feel a little bit more comfortable with. Because I'm not as academic as I seem, and I like a good film. So, so me and Ross picked out a few films that we think are significant. Some of them have the landscape in, and most of them don't.
They don't, do they?
But I just wanted to see why we thought that might be. So, I guess the first film that we both thought of was Nosferatu.
Yeah, which I haven't actually seen, believe it or not.
What?
I know, can't believe
this. Wait a minute, we need to stop because I don't think you're allowed to be on the podcast anymore. Ross!
I'm almost, because after taking me this long to not see it, I'm almost like, do I just deliberately not see it for the rest of my life? Or how do I find the perfect time to watch it?
You must go and see it. They must be showing it at, like, a film festival. You'd see it at a film festival with, like, a piano accompaniment or something.
What I need is for them to show it in Whitby Abbey on Halloween, and that's the only time I'm ever going to be feeling like it's, you know.
Right, I'm going to keep an eye out for that, and I will drive you there.
Okay.
And drop you off.
We're putting a grant to, like, Leeds Inspired to show Nosferatu in Whitby Abbey. I'm sure they want to fund another city's, another town's kind of entertainment, and just for me.
I'm shocked, Ross.
I am shocked, even though I knew that fact.
Right, okay, well, we'll just skim over that.
Yeah, let's move on.
Anyway, they do not show Whitby in Nosferatu. But I think like the portrayal of Dracula Nosferatu in that is very iconic.
Yes.
The spooky, spooky long man.
Don't spoil it.
With his long fingers and sort of like pointy face. Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't show the Yorkshire landscape. And then I guess probably one of the most famous next ones is Bela Lugosi's Dracula in 1931.
Love it. Have you seen that one? Yes. I'm sure it's great, isn't it? It does a lot in quite a short amount of time.
Yeah.
It's great.
I love, I'll come on to it when we talk about, the next one is the Hammer Dracula, which is one of the most famous ones. That's 1958. And I love how sort of like films before 1960, like cult classic films, just end so abruptly. Like, just like, oh, he's drowned and it's done. And then the credits come up and you're like, oh, what happened to everyone else? Did they get home? Okay, I don't know. So how do you feel about the Hammer Dracula? I personally love it.
I love it too. I think it does a clever thing in that it really streamlines the novel, which, I mean, gosh, like I've already said, it's practically an encyclopedia. Loads of kind of almost extraneous characters. What the Hammer one does really well is turn it into a fast-paced, exciting story. And of course, you've got those two fantastic actors. I can't even choose between them, but I do love Peter Cushing. I think he's just amazing.
And like, I think surely Hammer is where the cape swishing comes from.
It's got to be.
It does swishy capes. We all need one.
And it's quite grisly as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know they did unearth some footage fairly recently, didn't they, that they thought was lost from Dracula's demise. And it is really effective and creepy and a bit gory.
Yeah. But again, we do not see the landscape in that. Okay, we just took a little break there, impromptu.
Garlic bread.
We did actually have some garlic bread, but it was not in that break. It was earlier on.
Did you do that deliberately as a tribute to vampires? Did you?
No, oh, right. I just eat a lot of garlic bread.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Don't we all?
Well, if we want to be safe from vampires, we do.
The thing is, I don't want to be safe from vampires. So I probably should stop eating so much garlic bread. Anyway, back to just going off on a garlic tangent. So we talked about the Hammer Dracula, 1958, and then we come to the 1979 Dracula, which is John Badham, which I haven't seen.
I've not. I really want to, though.
So John Badham, you'd said, also directed Saturday Night Fever and Short Circuit, and that is a Laurence Olivier version, so we really must watch. I'm going to assume that it doesn't show Whitby in it.
I actually know a little bit about this, actually, because I read this really, well, I didn't fully read the book, but in the library, where I went to do a little bit of research, I read this book called Dracula's Whitby, and I've forgotten the author, which is terrible. We'll put it in the notes. But he has a nice story that was always his favourite version of Dracula as a child, as a film, this particular one. And then he discovered that the beach he used to play on when his family went holidaying in Cornwall, there was a bit of a shipwreck that he used to love exploring. This is sort of like a shipwreck on the beach, and he loved playing in it. And then he realised that this was actually part of the film set for that 1979 movie, and he had been playing in the set of his favourite film. And that's, I just think that's
such
really nice,
a cool fact.
But also a bit sad that the fact that passing Cornwall off as Whitby.
Yeah.
But I still like it.
That is a great fact.
I still want to see it.
I mean, you can't deny that Cornwall's nice.
Yeah. And apparently, there's a castle on the hill, and that's why they picked it. Apparently that version of Dracula is based on a Broadway show, and the show was done in black and white on stage. So they weren't, because studios are really paranoid about these things, they wouldn't let John Badham film it in black and white, so instead he decided to desaturate all the costumes as much as possible to make it pass for black and white, which is so intriguing and one of the main reasons that I want to see that.
Maybe we should watch it together.
Okay, well
that's on the list. The next one is the 1973 Jack Palance as Dracula.
This is the one I've watched most recently. I didn't have high hopes for it. It was, as you say, it was made for TV, but it was great. Dan Curtis is a really good kind of horror director. He's done various, you know, he did Dark Shadows, that spooky soap opera, and he's done a lot of TV movies. And it's a really good Dracula adaptation. The Transylvania sections are amazing.
Yeah.
And the rest of it's all set in Whitby. It's not filmed in Whitby, but it doesn't bother going to London. And I think that's an interesting creative choice. You know, do away with London, not Whitby.
And set it
in Whitby in Transylvania. So I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah. So the last one that I watched was the 1977 BBC version. And I'm very happy to say that a lot of it is filmed in Whitby.
Yeah,
finally. Very, very clearly filmed in Whitby. So just before recording, I just found a little bit on YouTube that me and Ross just watched together. And it's Whitby, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's so good to see the cemetery. Yeah. And it is, you know, unchanged. And it's just great.
Yeah. So there's some scenes at the beginning. So the only thing that's strange about it, so I would say that it's really quite true to the book. One of the stranger things that I thought about it was that they have Mina and Lucy as sisters, which I was saying earlier kind of takes away some of the, what I think is very clear sexual tension away from between the two girls.
Yep.
I think like Mina is possibly, has some like romantic love for Lucy, and that comes across when she's sort of the way that she speaks to her and about her and the way she writes about her and the way that she like touches her and that kind of thing. And obviously that's taken away the elements for the most part, I think, in this adaptation. Yeah. But it's a really nice version, and there's some quite good, fun 70s special effects. It's definitely like a TV version, but I really enjoyed it. But yeah, so in the beginning parts, when they first got to Whitby for the holiday, they're sat up in the daylight on the in front of the church, looking out over the sea and talking to Mr. Swales and all the old Yorkshiremen, and it's just clearly they are there being filmed on the cliff. And then the bit that we just watched is the bit that I was saying was one of my favourite bits, is where Lucy is sleepwalking up the 199 steps up into the graveyard again, and is met with Dracula initially as a bat, and then as Dracula the Count.
Yeah, quite man. Bloody as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that's clearly, they're still there.
Yeah.
It might be.
And that's where Bram Stoker was as well, sing.
Absolutely.
Not in that version. I think I've made, like I've set that up wrong.
Yeah. It was a really nice, it was really nice to see that it was, that it was filmed there, and like that they kept that like proper significance of the place. Mm-hmm. It's quite significant part of it is clearly filmed there. I think it really adds to the, for me anyway, it really adds to the overall feeling of the film, and it keeps it nice and northern, that bit.
Exactly.
So the next one, which we have to mention, just because it is probably the most famous version, I would say, like globally, is the 1992 version by Coppola. And it's it called Dracula? What is it called?
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Bram Stoker's Dracula. And funny that, because it's not really very true to the book.
It tries to be, doesn't it? It packs everything in terms of locations, names, but you're right, it doesn't really tell the exact same story.
I watched that 2 weeks ago as well, so I've watched that again recently, and it's a great film.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It's still...
Yeah, it's so glamorous, so, like, so sexy.
Yeah.
All the costumes are great, like... The two Americans that they have playing as the English people are fine. But it's really quite fabulous. But no mention of Whitby, no mention of Yorkshire, no mention of that travel up there.
Which is quite a thing, isn't it, really? The more we talk about it, the more I think, wow, it's such a key location.
Yeah.
To strip that away. I mean, I know you have to make these decisions, but that is a film with a broad canvas.
Yeah.
And this could have been such an extra dash of colour on it.
I know, couldn't it? So we've also got... I think we were saying this earlier, and I'll touch on it a bit later when we talk about another version, is that it's interesting that they can show Transylvania as this, like, odd place, but then they don't have this other odd place, because no one will have heard of Transylvania either.
True.
So I don't know. It just baffles me a bit as to why it's omitted from the film, but you know, I have to mention it because it's probably the most famous one, and it is. It's a very fun film.
It's well worth a watch, isn't it? I think teenage me liked it more than adult me.
Yeah.
But it's still a unique film, and it's very well done.
Yeah, and that was 1992. So I know that there's been iterations since then, but Oh, so we do have a 2013 version, which is John Rhys-Meyers as Dracula. And I haven't seen it, but you said you maybe watched the first one, so that was a...
Oh, was that the TV series?
The TV series, yeah.
I think I watched the first episode and sort of didn't really see the point. Maybe I was a bit Dracula'd out. Because wasn't there also one with Luke Evans, I'm just remembering now, a sort of a cinema one, when they tried to reboot that whole Universal Monsters franchise?
Oh.
And I remember going and seeing that in the cinema and thinking it wasn't as bad as the reviews had made out, but then it's Dracula, I'm going to love it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think at that point it was just a bit much Dracula stuff going on. None of it was really that brilliant or inspired.
Yeah. So the next one is... I enjoyed this really, really thoroughly when it came out in 2020. And so did you, I think.
I did.
So this is the three-part Dracula that was made by the BBC for Netflix. I think it was originally just BBC, and then I think Netflix must have bought some rights to it or something. But I've just watched them all again. So that's in three parts, and it's really quite an unusual new take on Dracula. So the three parts are in different timelines, and some of it is very true to the book, some of it is completely different. It's got all the good characters in it. I think the acting is fantastic. So it's made by Matt Gaetis and Stephen Moffat. So, like, personally, I think you can probably trust them that it's going to be good. You know, they made Sherlock.
They know what they're doing. They know how to turn a kind of a classic text into, you know, give it a modern twist and turn, you know, really ramp up the storytelling. Yeah.
And so we found out recently, so we both watched this when it came out in 2020. And when I was sort of doing a bit of research for this episode, I was trying to find out, you know, what versions of Dracula had actually been filmed in Whitby. And you'd said, oh, there's one of the BBC ones, the Netflix BBC ones. And I was like, what, really? So I went back and watched the first one and then half of the second one a couple of weeks ago. I was like, are they filmed it in Whitby and you just can't tell or something? And then... today, the day of recording, I was just doing a little bit of like last minute cramming, so just can't be an actual adult and do things on time. And it's actually the third episode. So now the third episode is quite controversial because it's set in the very modern day, 123 years later. So apparently Dracula has been asleep for 123 years and then he returns. And sure enough, we watched a bit of it earlier on, didn't we? And right at the very beginning, there it is.
Loads and loads of Whitby. Like overhead drone shots flying around.
Yep, Dracula washes up onto the beach at Whitby. You see the Abbey. There's a bit where they're driving the car around the side of the Abbey, as it is now. But they do drive the car onto the in front of the Abbey, where we now know that the gift shop is.
Yes.
And that is Van Helsing's like laboratory.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a shame, really, because that gift shop's probably the best gift shop in the country.
Yeah, it is. And it's been ruined by science. So yeah, that was a really, really nice surprise, and I think it's great. So through researching this, I've looked up, you know, like films, music, books, audio, all sorts about anything that I could find about Dracula that I could just like dip in and out of over the past month. And one of the things that I did find on BBC Sounds was they have a podcast series called Obsessed. Is it Obsessed With?
Yes.
Obsessed With, and they do all different TV shows. There's like a Killing Eve one and a that's all I can think of off the top of my head. But there is a Dracula one from when this came out, and it's three interviews with Stephen Moffat and Matt Gaetis about the three episodes. And I've listened to some of the third one, and they specifically said it was really important to us to film one of the episodes, or some of it specifically, this third episode in Whitby.
Really?
Yeah, to try and sort of, stay true to the book, because they also made the point that people haven't done that, like landscape-wise, and... they obviously agree that it's such an important part of the story that they wanted it to be there. So whereas, like, this is kind of spoilers, I guess. I'd definitely go and watch it. Like, it's a strange adaptation, especially the third episode. But I thought it was really fun.
Yep.
So in the first scenes, basically, Dracula gets surrounded by a SWAT team on the beach. but it is in Whitby.
And I just think, yeah, there's so many adaptations of Dracula. What's the point in trying to slavishly copy the book or another version? You know, if you've got some interesting ideas, go for it. And I think that adaptation does.
Yeah. So what they were also saying, which is what I mentioned earlier as well to you, was that they saw Whitby as an important part of it, which kind of mirrors what you said earlier about it being the mid-place. So they were saying, like, when the book came out in the 1890s, people would have been quite excited to read about somewhere that was so literally and metaphorically foreign, like Transylvania.
Yeah.
And then, like, familiarity but glamour of London.
Yeah.
And then there's this other place which is also unfamiliar and exciting and gothic. So you've got gothic Transylvania, you've got gothic Whitby, and then you've got glamour of London with Lucy and all her boyfriends and all this glamorous lifestyle. And then they go to this other place and everything's like, something's off everywhere.
Yes.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, it's these places that might be somewhere like London and Whitby are more familiar, but there's something off when they go to Whitby. And then there's something very off when Jonathan Harker goes to Transylvania. So.
And that's, I think in a way that's horror in a nutshell, isn't it? It's, you go to the place you're not supposed to go and something comes back with you, or, you know, infects your current world.
Uh-huh.
And as we both agreed, Dracula's all about infection and kind of, this. Well, there's just so many ways of reading it and taking it as different metaphors. Yeah. And yeah, I think Whitby, the sort of evil of Transylvania infects Britain via Whitby, and then the evil of Whitby kind of crawls down to London, and it's just so powerful, all of it.
So that's kind of how I wanted to talk about the TV adaptations, without going, you know, on and on forever and ever and try to like make everything into like a theory, I suppose. But I thought it was a really interesting concept to talk about. But sort of from that, I know that you have got a couple of things that you wanted to mention. So you've got a couple of books and...
Oh, yes, absolutely. So my friend Rashpal lent me this book that he enjoyed reading as a child. It was published in 1989. And the reason I thought it was worth a mention is it's also written by a Yorkshire writer, as well as being set in Whitby. So the book's called Room 13, and it's by Robert Swindells, who's from Bradford. Mm-hmm. He's quite a well-known children's writer, and I think he's still alive. He's won the Carnegie Medal at least once, perhaps twice. Not for this book, but it's a really good nostalgic read in a way, because if you've ever been on a school trip, which I'm sure most people have, this book is all about a group of children who go on a school trip to Whitby, and I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say they encounter Dracula. the book we've been talking about, Dracula, this is also filled with descriptions of Whitby. It does that thing of seeing the journey to Whitby through the child's eyes on the bus, on the school bus, as they travel from Bradford via Leeds to Whitby. It describes every street that they go down, every beach that they play on. There's loads of humorous interactions between the teachers and the pupils. Mm-hmm. And it also has, I'm not going to read it out because that will be too much of a spoiler, but it has a really interesting description of Dracula in this book. Dracula is basically hiding out in Whitby, and he's lost a lot of his power, and he's surviving by preying on school children and things like that. So he's a bit of a shadow of his former self. And actually, when it comes to the confrontation towards the end, it's quite vividly done, and the actual portrayal of Dracula is probably not one I've ever seen anywhere else. So if you want a different take on, you know, actually the visual appearance of Dracula and his kind of motivations. For a children's book, this is a really surprisingly original one. Yeah. So that's Room 13 by Robert Swindells. Seek it out. It's still in print. It's a really fun, quick read, but also it brings another interesting kind of angle to Dracula, I think. And it's got all that Yorkshire connection.
I love that. I'm definitely going to go ahead and read it. I did say I'm going to try and get hold of it before we record, and I didn't. I'm really excited to.
I'm sure Rashpal won't only mend it, passing that on to you.
Yeah.
I have to name drop him because he is such an expert in horror, but he refuses to come on a podcast because he's too shy, I guess. But he knows so much about horror as well.
I'm shaking my head. Rashpal, come on the podcast. You're welcome anytime. So my other input was, so I was speaking with my aforementioned friend Paul about sort of the influence of Dracula and the Whitby landscape on popular culture and music specifically. And the one track that came up was The Barguest or Whitby by My Dying Bride, which is a 27-minute track from 2011. Even the cover... oh, I think we might have just paused by accident because my battery's going low. Anyway, so I'll go back to the beginning. So my other input was from my friend, aforementioned friend Paul, and it was from... I don't know what genre would you'd say they are. Black metal? I don't want to offend anyone by saying what genre it is. But yeah, the band My Dying Bride, they have a 27-minute track from 2011 called The Barguest o' Whitby. And it's really quite the dirge, I guess. That's not a diss. Like, I like it. I've listened to it quite a lot over the past, like, month or so. And it's obviously clearly influenced by Dracula and Whitby, hence the name. And like even the cover, I was showing you the cover is, you know, the big black dog with the whip with the abbey in the fabulous background. We did have a discussion about why there aren't more songs specifically or music that are directly influenced by Whitby and Dracula, and it might be that it might be seen as a little bit cheesy.
I guess so. There's just been so much rather than
like
done.
Cool and gothic. I guess it can come across as being a bit like, ugh. But
if anyone knows of any,
I would just go for it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So I've made a note of some of the lyrics, which are obviously directly influenced by Dracula. So, a scent of blood is your undoing, through oak that grown under the rain. Under my feet, the world arcane. In suffering, I was always right. Within the silver moon tonight, from my lips, the word is sung, and in this voice, thy will be done. It is my sins that you deplore, count them fair, for I have more. To my mouth, I carry you in crimson teeth. The breath I drew, I make you dust as you were flesh. Honoured to see a performance in death. We have no time, no time at all. There's empty rooms and shadowing halls. Justice done with dark blood and scum, I'm torn towards the north from northern moors. They know I'll come, so Whitby is the source. Where you would sit and wait for me, I arrive at Saltwick Bay, and so you shall taste my grease, drawing the cut, I am away.
They really get it, don't they? They really get that Whitby connection. They're addressing the balance.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a whole other 26 minutes of that, so go and listen. I really like the track.
I'll definitely listen to that in full. It sounds amazing.
You should. It's very looming. Lots of good noise. Definitely need headphones to listen to that one.
Amazing.
So that was, I mean, it's kind of like a very brief like rundown of what I had sort of in my brain. But I really hope that for people listening, it's kind of got across what I was trying to like have a discussion about, really. And I'd really like to hear if people have got other thoughts about it, or if people have got things that they know are influenced by the Whitby, Yorkshire coast landscape in particular. Anything to do with Whitby, any adaptations of Whitby that we haven't seen.
Yes, that would be great to know
any
about.
Any books, any music.
Yeah, other kind of spooky things set in Whitby. Yeah,
and I did think about like art and things that might be influenced by it. And I really think that Dracula is such an important part of Yorkshire.
I'm so glad that we have this connection between Yorkshire and Dracula.
Me too. Just solidifies it as being like the spookiest place. And any chance I get to talk about vampires, like, I'm all for it. Okay, so on that note, what we always do at the end of the podcast is we talk about something that we have enjoyed.
Yes.
So would you like to go first?
I know what I will talk about. That I read the book Yellowface recently by R.F. Kuang. And it was great. And it also involves a famous horror location in the story. I'm not going to say any more than that because it would spoil it. But I was so delighted when it kind of arrives at this destination. And it is, the whole book is very sort of multi-layered read. And it has this great ending as well.
Are you
going
to tell me what it is when I turn the recorder
off?
Okay,
go on then.
Yes, I won't tell anyone. I won't put it in the description or anything. So my thing is I've just been on a little holiday with my family to the Yorkshire coast. So I've been up to near Bridlington, which is not that far away from me. I just had the most wonderful time. Like in the sea, we went to the Bridlington beach and I went to Humbumby Gap, which is really beautiful. Yeah, it was lovely. And then yesterday, on my way home, I went to apparently the most famous deserted medieval village like ever, which is called Warren Percy. And yeah, I kind of went like 5:45 in the evening on my own down this 3/4 of a mile track to a deserted medieval village. And I'm kind of going to leave it there and just let people...
What's in the village? I need to know.
There is... it's apparently the most excavated medieval site.
Right.
So it was excavated between 1950 and 1990. So there were people on the site for all that time excavating. So yeah, there is still the remains of a 15th century church. You can actually like walk in it. It's I kind of thought it was gonna be a lot less there than there was. And there is a barn, sort of like a barn house, that looks kind of like intact, but that's because it was used for the people who were excavating the site up until the 90s. So like it's got, you know, windows and things, but that was built in the 1700s. And then there's all these sort of like excavated foundations in the floor. So apparently when it was sort of like a bustling village, I say bustling, there was, about 250 people there at one time.
Enough.
So yeah, but it really did feel very odd to go there. Like I was saying to you, and it wasn't spooky, but it was strange.
Yeah.
I think because I was like completely on my own.
Yeah.
And you just feel, really do feel like you're in the middle of nowhere and you can feel all this history and got like the eeriness of it. So the churchyard still has some gravestones. So one cool fact is that when the sites that have been excavated, a lot of the bodies, apparently there were about 700 bodies excavated from there. A lot of them had signs that they were marked or had things cut off them to make sure that they didn't come back.
Oh, that is creepy.
Yeah.
There needs to be a story set there.
Apparently there's an episode of... Oh no, I'm going to forget what it's called. Oh no, I'll put it in the description. There's a TV episode of something that's been on recently. Someone told me about it this morning, specifically about the site. It's an English heritage site. It's not like you can't find out about it. I was just thick enough to have never heard of it.
Well, to be fair,
drove past the sign
it,
on my way to Bridlington and was like, I'm going there on the way back.
Gosh, I need to go.
Yeah, it was great. So yeah, the church was actually in use up until the mid-1800s from surrounding villages. So the gravestones that are left are like late 1700s up to mid 1850s. And some of them are still intact. You can read them. It's a very strange.
What a unique place. I don't know if I've really been anywhere like that.
I don't think I had either, just standing there to be, you know,
explored.
So apparently the person that sort of, we'll say, discovered in inverted commas before it started being excavated was in 1946.
Right.
So they sort of went on a walk and sort of walked down there and been like, oh wow, this is here. but yeah, it was a very strange and like unique experience going there. And if you're in Yorkshire or you're passing through or whatever, I'd definitely make a little trip. It's an interesting little walk down. It's not far, it's just under a mile to walk from like the main road down into the village. But you definitely feel like you're sort of in another world, really.
Creepy.
So that's my highlight of the month. Maybe of the possible few months, maybe of the year. So yeah, so that's that. So thank you so much for coming on again, Ross. It's been a bit of a chaotic episode, but I'm hoping that some people have got something out of this because I really loved thinking about Alder.
Yeah, it's great. Just as a reminder, for you know, to read Dracula if you haven't, or read it again if you have, because it's a book that just has so much more than you remember.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So I'm sure you'll be back again. So there was an exciting announcement at the beginning of this podcast. I'm going to talk about it at the end as well when I'm back to do my solo bit. But as part of the upcoming live No Heathen Land, Ross Horsley is going to be there.
Surprise.
Surprise. I hope you don't get any like better offers before the date.
Oh no, the new Lancashire podcast. But...
No, yeah, no. Although you are from there, so you outed. Should. Now, I think we said this in the first episode, okay, that you're not actually from Yorkshire. You're, but you've been here long enough. It's, yeah. You're honorary. Yep. So yes, Ross will be there as part of the live podcast with two other guests as well, who I will talk about. Maybe the next one. Stay tuned. So we're going to bring people back to find out who the other two guests are that are going to be at the live podcast. But I think Ross is probably enough for everyone because he's just so great.
Oh, thank you. I always love chatting to you, Sally, and I love listening to this podcast when I'm not being on it.
Oh, that's nice. So, yes, more about that soon. And thank you, Ross, for being a guest.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.